Large U.S. corporations like Walt Disney, Warner Brothers, and Comcast suspended their ads on X in protest against his alleged anti-Semitism. This has, of course, been lobbied for by Israel's spy agency, the Anti-Defamation League, for some time. The U.S. government has even issued a statement condemning Musk for the abhorrent promotion of anti-Semitic and racist hate. In October, when Israel cut all electronic communications in Gaza, Musk offered to provide his Starlinks to internationally recognized aid organizations in the Strip. This infuriated the Israelis, who vetoed the idea immediately. While on his trip to the settler entity, Musk commented to Israeli President Isaac Herzog that he supported the idea of re-education camps in Gaza to prevent another generation of resistance. He also commented that he would help establish economic prosperity in the area. With the constant stream of contradictory messages, the battle for the soul of Elon Musk continues.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And I'm delighted to welcome Ghadi Francis as our guest today. Ghadi is a Lebanese war correspondent who's worked for Al Mayadeen, Al Jazeera and others. And over the years, she's reported directly from conflict zones in Syria, Iraq and Yemen. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. What do you think went on with Elon Musk in the Zionist entity then? Interesting trip, wasn't it?
Well, it was very curious, wasn't it? I mean, we saw that footage, didn't we, of him with Netanyahu with his flak jacket on,
yes,
strolling around the kibbutz, looking perplexed and interested. And we saw all sorts of statements about how awful it was that the Israelis were facing what they were, and how From the River to the Sea was an anti-Semitic call for genocide and wouldn't be allowed henceforth on Twitter or X. So we saw, essentially, in that trip, we saw him becoming an obvious and stated Zionist. Now, of course, that's not quite the full story, but that's what we saw there. We saw him looking at that crib. Remember the crib with the bullets in it, which it transpired were not, in fact, resistance bullets, IDF or IOF bullets. So we saw a performance there, which looked very worrying for those who had believed his stories about freedom of expression.
Yeah. I mean, Ghadi, what's the opinion of the resistance access in the Middle East towards Musk, do you think?
Well, I don't know if I can really say the resistance access, because it's quite big, and like there's a spectrum of ideologies in the resistance access, and I'd say it is also the same when it comes to Elon Musk visit. Some people really paid attention to that and others found it irrelevant. As in, we've never expected more out of such personalities. No. For people in the Middle East, for people in the resistance of access, a big tech personality that has always been aligned with the U.S. foreign policy and that does these kinds of businesses for them, we don't expect him to come and say free Palestine. I think for me personally, nothing was surprising.
No.
What he did wasn't surprising. And also there were these resurfacing anti-Semitic comments that he had done. And we have seen that in history previously, whether it's scientists or businessmen or actually Microsoft and other tech companies, when they do such things, they have to whitewash what they did, and they end up being first front line of the Zionist propaganda just to make up for what they had done previously. So when it comes to the axis of resistance, they never took Elon Musk as an ally. So I don't think the expectation was really more than that.
No, indeed. Well, David, I mean, how exactly then did the Anti-Defamation League and the Center for Countering Digital Hate actually lobby Elon Musk then?
Well, they did a number of different reports and accusations about him being anti-Semitic, but of course also they did a specific report on this program, if
indeed
you recall, done by the Center for Countering Digital Hate, an organization created in this country but also having a DC office, which was also co-published by the ADL. And of course, that suggested that we were a vehicle for Iranian state propaganda, and that we casually gave out anti-Semitic comments week after week, entirely false, of course, and a report based on ridiculous research that hasn't even got names attached to it, so you can't tell who wrote it. So that was the way in which they did it, and of course, it's interesting that that as you said at the beginning of the programme, that when he took over, our Twitter accounts, the Twitter account for the show, were labelled as Iran state-affiliated media, we were shadow banned, and all that fell away, and really what you've seen with pro-Palestine accounts on Twitter in the last month or so is a massive increase in followers and reach, and that doesn't appear to be, there's some signs that there's a kind of rowing back on the algorithm in relation to that, in relation to particular accounts, but it doesn't in general appear to be the case. On the idea that somehow that Musk would outlaw from the river to the sea as a hashtag, well, I mean, it only massively increased after he said that, and I don't believe that anybody has been banned, as far as I'm aware, for using the hashtag. I certainly haven't been put into control measures for it. So it looks like that there's a real problem there for them, because overwhelmingly social media users on Facebook, on X, on Instagram, on TikTok are pro-Palestine, and there's not much they can do about that. Mm.
Gordy, I mean, how do you think Elon Musk's management of Twitter, or X as it's now known, compares to other platforms like Instagram, for example?
Well, if you want to compare to Meta, to Instagram and to Facebook, he'd look like the angel.
Because
the prohibitions...
It's a low bar, though, isn't it?
Really, because we've been working our words around the shadow bans on Instagram and melons and all kind of vegetables just to convey the message we want to say. It has also become something global. So if we want to compare that to X, formerly known as Twitter, well, it's still, we can still articulate our thoughts without being slaughtered virtually like it's done on Instagram and Meta. But still, it's not really safe out there. And we see it very, it's like walking on eggshells when you really want to say, to speak your mind. And you're not being racist or it's not really hate or violence. When you want to articulate a thought of resistance, you are walking on eggshells. But you get all these trolls that are basically literally saying that you should be killed and that babies should be killed. And they're always there. Yeah. And they don't get the same kind of security police. No. Well, this is up so far. This is what I've been seeing. It is not, there's no justice in regulating how we're being attacked. But there is always a police watching what our words are. Mm. Well, but still, it's not really as secure as it once was, because there's this one person who has been sitting next to Benjamin Netanyahu, and this is the person in charge. So we don't know when overnight, for example, I have a verified account. I don't know when overnight it wouldn't be verified anymore, because I've been saying Free Palestine ever since I was born.
No,
you know,
indeed,
so
of course,
I'm not allowed to exist on X, probably.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly a sort of an idiosyncratic sort of character, isn't he, Elon Musk? And I mean, and some of the positions he's taken, David, do sort of indicate a degree of independence, don't they, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would take two examples. One is, of course, the example of Ukraine, where he started to say to the US government that they would have to start paying for Starlink. Mm. And then he also refused to allow them to have Starlink. On a particular moment when they were trying to attack the Crimea. So that the Pentagon didn't like that very much. Americans didn't like that very much. That was an indication of that he can't, he was saying, we can't be used for aggressive purposes. And in a way, that's what he's saying on Gaza too, where he's talking about developing. Yes, he talked about re-education camps, of course, the ridiculousness that it was. But he also talked about regeneration, investing in Gaza. And of course, that means profits for him. But it's not quite as straightforward as a simple genocidal Zionist approach. I mean, I would also say that, that when he came back from visiting the settler colony, he did that famous interview where he said about advertisers, they can go F themselves.
Yes, right? Indeed.
I mean, pretty extraordinary. Now, the people he's talking to there is the ADL and the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, who have been the ones who've been behind the advertiser boycott. On the one hand, he's saying to Netanyahu, oh, well, I'm fully behind the Zionists and you shouldn't be calling for the end of Israel. On the other hand, he's saying to the ADL, absolutely not, I'm having nothing to do with you. So that's a real indication that there's something contradictory in his personality or his way of doing this. And it's partly, I guess, his kind of libertarian ideas about freedom and that kind of thing, which is behind that. But it's a deeply contradictory approach, isn't it? But some of the elements of it are quite interesting.
Yeah, no, indeed. Well, we're just going to pause the discussion there for a moment, because I'd like to get both of your thoughts after this about Elon Musk's involvement with Israeli companies and, indeed, regime change operations.
The history of Elon Musk's tumultuous love affair with Israel has had some fascinating twists and turns. Musk borrowed $1 billion to buy Twitter from Larry Ellison, one of the biggest known financiers of the Israeli military. Because of their close relationship, Ellison extended an offer to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to become a director of his software business Oracle, and even was due to be a witness for Netanyahu at his delayed corruption trial. Additionally, Authentix, an Israeli company founded by former Israeli intelligence officials, is working with Musk on his X platform. The new ID verification process, which asks users to provide legitimate ID documents and selfies, is administered by Authentix. It is a project of the Dutch security company, ICTS International, which was established by former Shin Bet operatives. Musk and his Starlink satellites were also implicated in the failed regime change campaign against Iran. When U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken mentioned the necessity of the U.S. government supporting Iranian protesters, Musk responded immediately with the words, "activating Starlink." Musk then publicly boasted about donating, quote, 100 active Starlinks in Iran, end quote, to help regime change rioters communicate. Elon Musk is also working closely with Israel to combat the resistance axis in the region. Musk's company, SpaceX, launched spy satellites for ImageSat International, an Israeli intelligence firm, to identify targets for airstrikes in Syria. The company's CEO, Noam Sigal, is an Israeli Air Force reservist. ImageSat International has been a critical component in Israel's 1,000 attacks on Syria in the past years. Both ImageSat International and the Israeli embassy in the United States officially thanked Elon Musk for the launch of their spy satellite above Syria on his X platform. Will his next service to Israel be the censoring of pro-Palestinian voices on the platform? Time will tell.
David, so this ImageSat International, just say a bit about its role then. I mean, it's mentioned in the video there, in the Israelis' bombing campaign in Syria.
So it's the tech which allows them, in part, the intelligence and the operational ability to carry out these attacks, 1,000 attacks roughly over the last few years. Attacks which have gone almost entirely unanswered, unremarked in the Western media. There's not been the capacity in the Syrian government or at least not the ability to counteract those. Not been any pushback really on that. And what we see there is this is part of a wider Zionist intervention in Syria. It's been in the Times of Israel just the other day that the outgoing occupation forces chief has admitted supplying weapons to, I think, 12 separate anti-government, pro-NATO proxy forces in the Syrian conflict. And, of course, we already knew from the famous Priti Patel visit to the Golan Heights, to the IDF field hospital, as it was called, the IOF field hospital, that they were patching up Nusra fighters and other anti-Assad fighters and sending them back to the conflict. So we know that this has been a full-scale involvement of the Zionists, along with the West and indeed with the Saudis and, of course, Qatar in that conflict. So that's an indication, really, of his role in regime change operations, just like the one that he's been involved in relation to Iran.
Did you think the information contained in these reports would change people's opinions in any way at all?
Well, unlike what would be expected, I don't think it would. Because if you're looking at, I think we had an example when Elon Musk came and did this tour with Benjamin Netanyahu. And I think the approach or the general view of Elon Musk is like a businessman selling his product.
Yeah.
So if his product is being used to kill us, our problem isn't with him, it's with the buyer. I don't know if I'm articulating it accurately, because we've seen, if they want to really be angry, the people in the region, angry at Elon Musk, they have to be angry at some states, some Arab states that are providing oil, gas, fuel and money and planes for the killers as well. So basically it's like they're buying his product, but they will not really hold him accountable. I don't think so.
Right. Well, David, I mean, just moving on then, I mean, what do you know about this character, Larry Ellison? Because he's pretty close, isn't he, to both Netanyahu and to Elon Musk?
Yes, and we've talked about Ellison before, this
yes,
company,
on the show, yeah,
Oracle,
yeah.
which I'll mention again in a minute. But of course, I mean, it's worth remarking, isn't it, on the fact that he just had to hand $1 billion lying about that he could offer to Musk, lend to him so he could buy Twitter and turn it into X. And Ellison is, as the film shows, extremely close to Netanyahu, offered him a place on the board. And Oracle, as a tech firm, one of the biggest tech firms, has been involved in multi-million dollar and pound contracts, in, for example, in the UK with the Ministry of Defence. So much of the cloud computing support for the Ministry of Defence in the UK is provided by Oracle, a company which has, through Ellison and through the senior staff at Oracle, direct links to Israeli intelligence. So we have a real issue here, again, with those kinds of links and with this mate being Larry Ellison, but at the same time, of course, Musk remains a contradictory character, even in the face of those kinds of links.
But Gadi, I mean, do you think then that Israel's found it easier or more difficult to deal with Musk than they did with the previous incumbents who controlled the Twitter platform?
Well, I'd say absolutely easier. Really? Musk is absolutely easier.
Right.
There's one person to deal with, and sure. you know where to twist their
yes,
arm.
Indeed.
And we obviously saw that in manifestation, like during the past 2 weeks. So I think Israel found Musk a way easier person to handle.
Mm. And David, I mean, what's the significance of Musk using Authentix, if I'm pronounced that correctly, for user verification? And why is that a problem?
Well, it means that you and I and Gary here, whenever we upload our data to become verified, have the blue tick.
But then again, aren't we giving that data with our phones and smartphones one way or the other to the same systems? That's my question to myself.
Mm.
WhatsApp.
We are, that's right.
Face identity. Super powerful tech companies are way smarter than that. I think they have all my information already. Mm.
They do, but the problem with them having it, of course, is the links that there are between those companies and, yeah. And Israeli intelligence. So, you know, and oh.
But for us in Lebanon, everything gets to the Israelis.
That's right.
Yeah.
The issue, it seems to me, is that this is not on the radar of the Western public. People don't know about this. And what we need to do is to, as you say, to push back against this in Lebanon, in the UK, in the US, and elsewhere, wherever it's happening, because this is a perennial problem which we have to deal with in addition to the more obvious manifestations.
It is very unfortunate that they have normalized it for us.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, it has been normalized in our brains that we are basically shared. All our data is shared one way or the other with the Israelis, whether it's on WhatsApp.
But through shows like ours, we can raise people's awareness, a consciousness of,
hopefully,
you know, about
it's never normalized.
About the downside. No, indeed. Well, we need to obviously be pushing back against that. But God, let me just move back and on a little bit and just ask you whether you think that the current wars will become a regional conflagration, or indeed you think it already is?
Of course. Thank you for the added part of the question. Well, this war in the region is 75 years old.
Yes.
Whether they say it is there or not, I haven't witnessed any day in my life where there hasn't been something done to my people. In Syria, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Iraq, in Yemen. So when is it war and when is it peace? People are dying every day. Aren't they precious to their parents, to their futures? Don't they have aspirations? So no, we have been in war because there is an apartheid ethno-state armed with billion-dollar funded weaponry, and it is killing and trying to kill each and every person from the indigenous peoples that are here. So the war is regional, because even before October 7, there wasn't any week without tit-for-tat attacks between the Axis of Resistance and the Israelis, whether it's in the sea or in Syria or in Iraq, Iraqi-Syrian borders, or Lebanon. I mean, in Lebanon, maybe it's semi-daily that we have Israeli planes in our... I hear them almost daily. And we wonder, when will they, like, attack us? Because they openly say they want to. Indeed. They openly say next is Beirut after Gaza. So the war... We have been living it, but the war hasn't been globally, outrageously displayed. We haven't been living a televised genocide, before. So when we say, is it going to spill to the region? I say the United States of America is involved in this war. It is already global, sir.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is already global.
Yeah. I mean, and the billion-dollar question that I mentioned at the beginning of the show is, will Elon Musk then... succumb to that pressure? I mean, whether perhaps get both of your thoughts on that. What do you think, Gadi?
I think Elon Musk is a businessman.
Yeah.
And he's going to put his mouth where the money is.
Hmm.
I know tech is really involved in this new era in the warfare. I know AI is being used to kill us and to kill our children. Hmm. And thank you for exposing that and working on that. But in the end of the day, I would regard him, in the worst case scenario, just like the big moguls that sell weapons or sell pharma, or like these decision makers. It's a blend of these. I wouldn't take Elon Musk out of that herd of people who are making money out of war.
Yeah. What do you think to the billion-dollar question?
I think that's right. I mean, the only curious thing about Elon Musk is that he has these kind of weird ideas about freedom of speech, which do seem to make a difference to how he runs the company, in contrast with how Twitter was before, where they were simply stuffed with Zionists at the top of the company, where they asked only Zionists to judge who should be on it and who shouldn't. Yeah. So that's the one distinction I would make.
Sure. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, because that's it for another show, as we're out of time again. I'd like to thank our guest, Gadi Francis, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
I would like to tonight, present to you a conceptual ground, first of all, about this whole idea of virtues of human beings, fadail-e insani, and then relate that to the personality of Bibi Fatima Zahra. Just to, first of all, lay down the conceptual ground of my discussion, I would like to go to the ayat from Surah Ahzab, Surah number 33, ayat 35. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the fada'il, the virtues of human beings. But in this ayat, he has used a very unusual style of speech. Normally based on the language those days, and even now, and it's not only Arabic, almost all the languages were that way, that if you look at the ayat of Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mostly talks in masculine form. Only some places, he also uses feminine forms. He says, aqimu salat, establish prayers or do the prayers. Although the words are in masculine form, everybody knows that the meaning is also for women. But in this ayat, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has gone out of his way, if I may use that term, and talked about the virtues of human beings using both masculine and feminine forms, repeating same thing again and again and again. You know, if this was a human writing, and if it given into the editor, he will say, oh, this is a very wordy paragraph. Why do you have to repeat the same thing in masculine and feminine? Just say it once, that's enough. If you look at the ayat, it says, إِنَّ الْمُسْلِمِينَ وَالْمُسْلِمَاتِ وَالْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَالْمُؤْمِنَاتِ وَالْقَانِتِينَ وَالْقَانِتَاتِ وَالصَّادِقِينَ وَالصَّادِقَاتِ وَالصَّابِرِينَ وَالصَّابِرَاتِ وَالْخَاشِئِينَ وَالْخَاشِئَاتِ وَالْمُتَصَدِّقِينَ وَالْمُتَصَدِّقَاتِ وَالصَّائِمِينَ وَالصَّائِمَاتِ وَالْحَافِظِينَ فُرُوجُهُمْ وَالْحَافِظَاتِ وَالذَّاكِرِينَ اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا وَالذَّاكِرَاتِ. It took me a long, you know, at least a minute or more. I could have done that in an Arabic, it would have been okay, by simplifying it. إِنَّ الْمُسْلِمِينَ وَالْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَالْقَانِتِينَ وَالصَّادِقِينَ وَالصَّابِرِينَ وَالْخَاشِئِينَ وَالْمُتَصَدِّقِينَ وَالصَّائِمِينَ وَالْحَافِظِينَ فُرُوجُهُمْ وَالذَّاكِرِينَ اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا. But no, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in all these 10 virtues that He describes for human beings, He repeats the masculine form and then the feminine form. Why has He done this? Just to make us realize that when it comes to the virtues of human beings, there is no difference in the potential of male and female. They are on the same level. Fadilat, when we talk about a virtue of a human being, the character of a human being, or the iman of the human being, that is not related to the body of the human being. It is related to the soul of the human being. And so when it comes to the potential to attain these fada'il, you know, it doesn't matter whether you are a man or a woman, male or a female, doesn't matter. Because it is something which has to do with your nafs and your ruh. And that is where the fazilat comes in, not on a physical level. Look at the story of Adam alayhi salam. The body of Adam was already complete, perfect. But the order to do sajda to the malaika, to Adam, only came when he says, وَإِذَا نَفَقْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِ. When I breath in him from my soul, then you do sajda. Sajda was not to the body of Adam. Sajda was to the nafs and the ruh of Adam. This is where, you know, shaitan didn't realize that the excellence given here to Adam is not the body. You are saying you created him from clay, you created me from fire. These are physical issues. And Allah is giving this honor to Adam because of this ruh, which comes with the characteristics of humanity and insaniya. Salawat padhein ek baar. So normally when we go to the tafsir of this ayat, you go through the 10, you know, items here, the qualities, one after another, and we explain the details and everything. Ra'atullah Nasir Makarim Shirazi in his tafsir in Namuna has actually tried to look at it from a different way. He's tried to, you know, group or describe the qualities in different ways. And in, you know, getting inspiration from him, I actually started reflecting on this ayat based on their reflection and came up with what I would call the pyramid of human virtues. And I divided them into 5 layers and divided these 10 qualities within 5 layers. When we look at the pyramid of virtues of human beings, the very first layer, which is the foundation of human virtue, the first 2 qualities, إِنَّ الْمُسْلِمِينَ وَالْمُسْلِمَاتِ وَالْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَالْمُؤْمِنَاتِ, Islam is the beginning of that process. Either you are born in a Muslim family or you convert into Islam. And you accept that. You submit yourself to that system that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent. Then you grow up if you're born in that family. Or if you convert, then you start taking it more seriously, studying about it, inshallah. A time comes when even a person who was born as a Muslim or somebody who came into the fold of Islam, you know, now he's not only part of the Muslim community, now he has this conviction in the faith and the beliefs and the values. It is a journey from the mind to the heart. Islam basically resides on the tongue. But Iman resides in the heart. It is a piece of decoration for the heart. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran talks about it. And so when the journey goes from here to here, then you have Islam and Iman. And that is the foundation, the first layer of the pyramid of human virtue. In the light of that, let us now look at, the seerah of Fatima al-Zahra, salawatullah alayha. She is a hujjat of Allah for us, just like the Prophet and the Imam. She is uswa hasana like her father, a good example for us. And when it comes to this foundation of the faith, or this pyramid of faith, you know, the position of Fatima is very unique. How would you talk about her Islam and Iman? I'll just simplify it by saying Fatima was born in the house of Islam. Her father is the one who brought Islam. And the mother is the one who first said labbaik to that call of Rasulullah. So in other words, if I may use this term, it might just be poetry, you know, you don't hold me against it. You know that Fatima is twin of Islam. The father of Fatima is the founder of Islam. They all come from the same source. And so this is as far as, you know, Islam or Fatima is concerned. When it comes to Iman, she is married into the house of Iman. Her husband is not only a mu'min, he is Amirul Mu'mineen. To love the husband of Fatima is the only litmus test that the Prophet has given to us to separate the mu'min from munafiq. When he says to Ali, that Ali, nobody loves you but a mu'min and nobody hates you but a munafiq.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali Hali Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I'm Umay Biha Mukhtar, your host on IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. Joining us today is Sister Salma Khalfan, a respected Islamic researcher, and she will enlighten us on the concept of hijab as guided by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So in the previous episode, we were talking about what Ayatollah Khamenei had to say about the situation of women and their hijab at the time of the Pahlavi rule. And we discussed a lot about it. It was very interesting. And towards the end, you mentioned it was very hard for women to preserve their hijab and dignity, especially in educational environments. Can you enlighten us more about this?
Yes, Ayatollah Khamenei has said that it was very difficult for a woman to also walk in the streets. Of Tehran and some other cities while she was wearing even partial hijab. It's sad, isn't it?
Very sad.
And it shows that women at that time also wanted that for themselves, the hijab. They were modest. They were a group of women who were going out in the study. Why in the streets of Tehran or other cities? It's because they were going out to pursue something, to work or go towards learning or education or universities, whatever it was. But they were wearing partial hijab. That even it was difficult for them. Reza Shah, he had really strongly decided to go against this. This shows that it was just a stubborn kind of attitude that he had, just to show the Muslims that they were not right and to show the West that you are right and we are puppets at your hands. So this shows that women at that time also were pious and wanted modesty for themselves. And also it shows that they wanted to pursue their knowledge, their education. And that's why they were out in the streets, right?
Yeah.
And this shows also that Reza Shah was so stubborn. He wanted to, actually show the West that we are adopting your ideas. Like it's a way of saying that, okay, you have some anwata atar, we are puppets at your hands. And that's not a very good thing, yeah? It's not a dignified thing for himself. In the long run, dignity did it leave for him now? Look, he's no more.
There's just a handful of people who somehow...
Leave alone the rule of the Shah.
Yeah.
This policy itself, did it leave some dignified memories for him?
No.
Zillat.
Yeah.
Just, disgrace. That's it.
Definitely.
They had made it almost, Ayatollah Khamenei continues, they had made it almost impossible for women to also acquire knowledge in this country, that is Iran. You know, they were just trying to prove it to the women that either this or that. Okay? So if you want knowledge, everybody would like to acquire knowledge. There were also people at that time who would love to have become doctors and everything. So it was giving them a choice that was very hard to choose, you know, from what to take and what to leave. So, of course, there were some exceptions, but it was not possible for most women to enter scholarly areas unless they agreed to give up the hijab and the Islamic piety and dignity. It shows that Ayatollah Khamenei says, unless they give up their hijab and the Islamic piety, means the hijab is one of the criteria of piety for a woman and her dignity. So it's very important in this case, in now day and age also, if you go and see women, if they want to get a shield for themselves, their protection, then they should observe this hijab and start, refraining from this kind of copying the cultural ideas of the West and mimicking their ideas.
Definitely. I feel like it kind of gives you this feeling of self-respect as well. That, I'm not defined by what I...
Or like a different, show. I'm different, I'm unique, right?
Yeah.
Ayatollah Khamenei wants that for us. In fact, Allah is, of course, all the commands is none other than according to the Quran and the Sunnah. So that's what he wants from us, that dignified look that uniqueness of a woman, that woman appears like a shining star, because woman plays the central role in the life of a man also. True. You know, like Om, they call it the source.
Yeah.
You know, that's so important. She's the source. Actually, she brings up the society in the long run.
So we're just going to, you know, pause briefly, and inshallah we'll resume in a moment. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we've been discussing about hijab at the time of the Pahlavi rule. And it's been very interesting, especially because we've been trying to understand that time and how hijab had a role to play and how it was kind of denied from the women. And if we reflect it to the times today, we realize that, you know, if this happens again, we're kind of denying that, you know, the right of hijab again, and we're going in towards immodesty. And we have seen how at that time the society got so corrupt. We don't want that to happen again. And I think that's the main reason why we're discussing this topic today.
Absolutely.
As well. And we're trying to understand that how, you know, the Western powers don't give infinite wisdom to us. They don't. It is Islam that gives us. It is Allah who gives us this. And we have scholars and our Ayatollah Khomeini and Khamenei who have been trying to emulate those concepts to us. And I think it's very necessary for us to, you know, keep that in mind.
Absolutely.
So what about the social progress of the Iranian women with the code of Islamic dressing? I'm sure our leader has loads to say on that, please.
Yes, absolutely, he does. Ayatollah Khamenei says that after the revolution, that is the Inqilab-e-Islami, Islam and Imam Khomeini placed women as the center of political activities and gave the flag of the revolution to women. They encouraged women. Our women stepped into the area of, and at the same time, managed to preserve their hijab, their dignity, their chastity, their faith and piety. So hijab lets us do this, you know. Hijab helps us, you know, like preserve our dignity, chastity, faith and piety. Nobody, like, this is a very good statement, I love it, when Ayatollah Khamenei says, nobody has done a greater favor to Iranian and Muslim women than this, you know, like giving this encouragement to come out and, you know, progress in the social field also with the chastity, with the hijab, with the modest dress and with faith and piety, of course, in the long run. As we saw during the revolution and as we can see now, says His Eminence, when Muslim women go back to their nature, they can make a great difference. You know, like as far as their nature is concerned, in the social area, they can really create an impact.
Definitely,
that's what,
yeah.
Ayatollah Khamenei wants to say. Thankfully, we have many knowledgeable women in various fields, diligent and gifted female students, highly educated women and prominent women doctors. In the Islamic Republic, various scientific fields are dominated by Iranian ladies. They preserve their morality, observe hijab, raise their children, because women in their fitrat, you know, want a family and they don't neglect their children.
Yeah.
So they raise their children in the Islamic manner, and whoever does, you know, according to the Islamic principles, will of course lay importance in raising their children and the Islamically that too, and take care of their husbands as well, preserve their family, and at the same time they engage in what? Political and scientific activities.
Yeah.
So it is completely possible for a woman with an Islamic character to fully realize her potential in an Islamic environment.
We can see like how much it's flourishing.
Yeah, Islamic environment is completely a possible thing for a woman to flourish and keep away from corruption, luxury, lifestyles, modeling, humiliation, part-time display of beauty, all these things, you know. So
kind of showing off and like you're reducing yourself to commodities where you have to, you're there to show your beauty.
And the sad thing is, you know what, the women know that they're commodities and they're very proud of it. That we are commodity that is best-selling commodity. They don't know that it's against their fitrah. They're doing the worst injustice to themselves.
Definitely.
Right? When they completely realize this, you know, and they accept it and they like it, that shows they've covered their fitrahs. And it's like a, sometimes it's sadly a point of no return. And that's why we see big actresses, you know, like in the West, dying and still beautifying themselves and not returning to the original fitra, not realizing that, oh, what I did was just a waste. No, they're proud of themselves. And people who follow them are so proud of them, you know, that such and such actress was this. She looked like this in 1984 and 1985 she was like this. Until 2023 she looked like this. Look how old she looks. And she died after that. Okay, now.
So successful.
Yeah, let's be silent and just remember her. That's it.
We also have those kind of women who, for example, there was one of them who was a singer apparently. And before she died, she wrote that, I wish I had lived my life in another way. I wish I had got a family. I wish I had children. It's like then it gets too late and you feel like so resentful that you've wasted kind of your life.
Exactly.
The purpose you've come for, you're no longer.
Yeah. It's even very rare that a person like this would have realized.
Yeah.
It showed that she was starting to read or to get enlightenment somehow.
So, we're just going to take a short break and we'll continue shortly.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we're discussing with Sister Salma Khalfan about the social progress of the Iranian women with this code of Islamic dressing and what our leader has said about that. I wanted to ask, what is the message of a faithful Iranian woman to the world according to the words of our Islamic leader? And what should be the message?
Yes, yes. Ayatollah Khamenei reiterates that from the social level of promotion of women and how they are reacting to it and how they want the whole world to know about the progress that they are making.
Yeah.
And that they should not lag behind too. It's like a tabligh, you know, that they are doing. That don't forget this. So Ayatollah Khamenei says that Iranian women, especially those who have managed to make scholarly achievements in different fields within the framework of Islam, Islamic teachings and hijab, should convince women across the world that acquiring knowledge is not synonymous with immorality.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be accompanied with immorality.
Definitely.
You can acquire knowledge, but with chastity together. By performing it, of course, yeah? So when you come out in the platform wearing your hijab and proving that point, people will see that how can she do it, I cannot do. France will see, how can this woman become such a successful doctor or a surgeon and I'm here not allowed to wear my scarf and pursue knowledge? No,
yeah.
There has to be something wrong, right?
True.
How can they say that you can't do this and then because then you can't, be famous in education? If this woman could reach so much like atop that everybody comes to, pay her a visit regarding her field and take benefit from her. So why shouldn't I even adopt to this policy of modesty, right?
Yeah.
So they have to convince all women that lack of commitment to moral standards in their relationship with men is not a prerequisite for acquiring knowledge. It's not like when you go and sit near a boy and have a co-educational school, that's when you'll become more clever. No, it has nothing to do. It's not a prerequisite for acquiring knowledge. It is possible to observe all these moral standards of Islam and achieve highly scholarly positions. There'll be so much more barakat too, right? Because of, following that innate fitrat, innate nature of yourself, especially a woman. A Western woman changed her religion because of what? Hijab. Why hijab? It gave her freedom.
She understood
the truth. She understood. She appreciated.
And I think that, if we look at the situation right now, what with all the sanctions and all the, money struggle that Iran is facing, yet it's progressing so much. It's really, it's very amazing to me personally. I feel like, okay, other countries say, oh, look, but even though Iran is, going up, but it's not going maybe as high as it could be if really hijab is and all this and women, we are empowering women. But no, it is. But they are kind of limiting our kind of our hands. They're like closing our hands because of all these limitations with the sanctions and everything. Otherwise, Iran could even go further. It's the people can also even go further. But because That's of it. All of these things that they themselves are limiting us, it's
and
preventing.
Because of the faith of Ayatollah Khamenei, he knows there's a wisdom behind it.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
He should not stop working.
Yeah.
And women should not also stop working and feel this is the end of the time now. Now, you know, there's nothing left in Iran. No, there's so much progress everywhere. You see tits and bits of progress going on.
True.
And it's like, you know, not a small wonder what with the faith.
Yeah, I really admire the people of Iran, honestly. And I feel like they're very special. And inshallah, you know, we can also be as strong as they are in these times
yes,
that they're facing.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. Thank you so much, Sister Salma Khalfan, for your valuable time. And we hope to see you in the next episode.
Inshallah.
I know I'm waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Hidden Files.
But do you condemn Hamas? This has been mainstream media's favorite question ever since Hamas's preemptive strike on occupied Palestine on October the 7th. But sadly for them, they're no longer the only media that people get their news from. After some 75 years of the ongoing genocide in Palestine, the journalists on the ground were finally able to get their voice across to people all over the world and to inform them of the bombings that have killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, mostly women and children. And that's when October 7th could no longer justify the ongoing genocide, even in the minds of former supporters of the Israeli regime. Now, many have already realized that mainstream media blamed Hamas to buy more time for the Zionist regime to murder as many Palestinians as they could and to occupy as much land as possible. But the question remains, from a legal perspective, who is responsible for the thousands of lives lost, especially since October the 7th? Hello, I'm Marzieh Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. This is the discussion that we will have today with lawyer and doctor of jurisprudence and human rights activist Stanley Cohen. Stay tuned, please.
Stanley Cohen is an American lawyer and human rights activist. Following graduation from college, Stanley started working as a VISTA volunteer and helped set up legal service projects in Native American reservations. Cohen then went on to work as a community organizer to tackle the issues of homeless teens and later as an administrator in a federally funded anti-poverty agency. He then went on to law school to defend human rights on a legal level and earned a doctorate of jurisprudence. Since then, he has worked on various lawsuits, from those taking on the NSA spying program to others involving false accusations targeting various minorities and individuals. Defending Patrice Lumumba against accusations of the material support of terrorism, and defending the Hamas political leader against extradition by the Israeli regime. Due to his success in various such legal projects, Stanley Cohen has for long been a target for smearing campaigns and various threats, which he has survived to date.
Well, thank you so much, Stanley Cohen, for being with us. I'd like to start off with mainstream media's favorite question. Do you condemn Hamas? And what are the legal definitions of their actions according to law?
I like to respond to that question with, who did you pick on before Hamas from, 1936 to 1985? The mainstream media likes to use Hamas as the convenient boogeyman, likes to use any quote-unquote Islamist movement, even one that's overseeing, with all the difficulties, the civil society that was voted into office. But it's always Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. So they look to October 7th, and they completely ignore the history of Israeli genocide, Israeli ethnic cleansing, Israeli war crimes, Israeli crimes against humanity, and they say it's Hamas. Do I condemn Hamas? No. Hamas is a national liberation movement that has been in the forefront of the resistance since 1985. It has a leadership that is highly educated, sophisticated, learned, committed to their people from Gaza. These are not people that one day got on a plane and came from Brooklyn, as the Zionists are, to some foreign country. These are people that grew up in Gaza, many of whom the leadership left over a number of years to pursue education elsewhere, received doctorate degrees. They're academics, they're scholars, they're lawyers, they're scientists, they're producers, they're directors, they're artists, and returned home to help to liberate Palestine. So do I condemn Hamas? No.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you, because you've represented many people who couldn't afford to pay you along the way. And I mean, given your expertise and your experience, you could have had a lot more money. Why did you choose a different path?
I recently had a discussion with a journalist who asked me the same question. I said, well, I'm sure Henry Kissinger did not get to take his money with him. I'm sure Bill Gates will not be able to take his money with him. We have to make choices in life. Is it about the pursuit of profit? Is it about the pursuit of power? Is it about political control? Or is it about being part of a world community that's here for a very limited period of time, since that they too were not going to spend their lives pursuing money, but pursuing justice?
Well, why did you, you've decided to represent a lot of Hamas officials and other groups too, although there would be repercussions for you? Why is that the case?
Well, I had, years before I represented Abu Marzouk, who was one of the founders of Hamas and was the original head of the political wing and is now still a major senior leader of the movement, I had been involved in supporting Palestinian self-determination, Palestinian independence, Palestinian liberation as a young lawyer. I organized some political actions. I was involved as an attorney representing people that were protesting against Israel years before even Hamas evolved. I had a very active role in a Muslim in the Islamic community in the United States, not trying to singularize it, because obviously it's a community of diversity with different priorities. In fact, through my work representing many dozens of Albanian Muslims who were charged with various situations in the United States, and who eventually, as a result of negotiations, went to Bosnia and joined the KLA with the approval of the United States, in essence fighting before the United States dragged NATO in, before the bombings occurred. That connected me in a different light to the Muslim community in the United States in general, and to the Palestinian community in particular. And then one day when I had just finished a very long trial and was getting ready to go on holiday for a few weeks, I got a call from the leaders of one of these organizations who asked me if I could go to the federal prison, that there was a gentleman who had been picked up suddenly on an immigration hold, someone who was a lawful resident in the United States. And I really was too tired and I couldn't do it. And I recommended other lawyers. And then as an aside, I said, well, who is this person? And then he mentioned a name to me, and the name didn't mean anything to me at the time. And he said, Musa Abu Marzouk. And I said, who was that? And then he said, well, I said, no, I'm tired. I need to get away. I've got family and friends that are expecting me. We've got a cabin on the ocean. And then he said, well, he's the head of Hamas. And I went, oh, okay. So I called my family and I said, look, you're going to have to do what you have to do on your own. I've got to go see this gentleman. And I went to meet Abu Marzouk. We spent a day or half a day talking. And I'll never forget, he looked at me when I walked in and he said, looked up and down at me, up and down. I had, my hair was all over the place and I had ripped dungarees on and I had a sweatshirt on that said, the first thing we do, quoting Shakespeare, will kill all the lawyers. And he looked at me and he said, who are you? And I told him, I used a certain term that I'd, a phrase that I'd been told to use to give him comfort that I wasn't there as a representative of the government, I'd been sent friends. And I used it. And he said, well, who are you? As he stared at me up and down, amazed, and looked at me, and I said, well, I'm a lawyer. And he looked at me up and